So now it's time for another edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. This time we're, well, it's June 1st, 2025, as I'm making it. And actually, that's as you're listening to it, I'm making it the day before. But hey, hopefully you'll get something out of it. We're also going to flash back after the checking out various voices from the a post office Food Not Bombs meal, which is where the Food Not Bombs meal was this Saturday on May 31st, to, we'll look in on some of the accounts, street accounts perhaps from the Huff meeting, and maybe a story or two that I just pull out of my files. So let's see what we get. Let's begin with the usual intro, which we're going to lead you into the a continuing panoply of songs by David Rovics, the history of the world, according to him. That's a musical history you're going to be listening to. And let's begin with our theme song.
Tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs, they simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic, I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking, why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you.
So let's begin with a story from Slingshot, which is a sort of a radical monthly or bi-monthly paper out of Berkeley, I think it is. This is issue number, well, spring 2025. Maybe it's a quarterly issue. It's the story I'm going to read is called Hand in Hand, and it's by, well, Henry, whoever he is. And it's subtitled, What If We Responded to Homelessness Like We Responded to Hurricane Helene? Hurricane Helene destroyed running water, electricity, cell phone, and Wi-Fi services in Asheville, North Carolina, original home of the Cherokee. It suspended gasoline supplies and threatened food shelter, and in many cases caused complete devastation to homes, businesses, beloved parks, and public spaces. As I talk with fellow residents in a makeshift version of the ice cream shop where I work, one of them exclaims that they've just found their first hot shower in a week at an emergency station down the road. Due to the destruction from the hurricane, the water system was no longer able to deliver water to our pipes, showers, and sinks. I was surprised by how quickly emergency shower stations appeared. I couldn't help but wonder, quote, if we can get aid to people in the midst of crumbling infrastructure, then why weren't we able doing this before for our unhoused community members, people who have lived this way for years? Why are more vulnerable people treated as less worthy of basic vital services than homeowners and renters? Asheville is a city, like many cities, that faces an extraordinary yet oddly common homelessness crisis. Our streets, nooks, and crannies are strewn with encampments of people surviving, many struggling with mental health issues, addiction, psychosis, transition from incarceration, and lack of family support. Because our shop is a place who greets all with a friendly welcome and open arms, it often serves as a place of refuge for those living on the street, and I get to know many unhoused folks' struggles and stories. They too had found these emergency showers. While many were devastated in this disaster, so many of the unhoused people I know suddenly had an improved quality of life. Care that they had gone without for years. Access to showers, hot meals, and essential supplies, and even free therapy on the street. It begs the question, why isn't homelessness treated as a crisis in the way that natural disaster is? I was surprised at how quickly help arrived and touched by how much it impacted the lives of the unhoused people who I am familiar with. The aid given after the storm also provided something beyond physical value. I saw hope and relief melt hung heads and cold nights. For the first time in such a long time, these unhoused people felt cared for. They were reconnected to the community. And weren't we all reconnected to our community in that same moment? There's no one in Asheville who has been untouched by the crisis. We came together and fought to care for our immediate needs. Many people in my life have noted how much the efforts of everyone around them personally got them through, physically and emotionally, the darkest days they had seen in a while. We let less fortunate survivors stay in our homes. We showered at friends of friends' houses. We shared our extra food or water that we had with our neighbors. We brought each other gasoline, carpooled, and offered rides. We checked on people's family members, some hiking miles to inaccessible areas for wellness checks. We even asked strangers if they were okay and had everything they needed. We went out of our way to try to account for everyone. It was the one silver lining to a complete catastrophe. The consensus at that moment was that we hoped to never forget how that connection felt. Remembering still brings tears to my eyes. After the storm, we now collectively share the experience of both the vulnerability of going without and the power of the community to solve a problem together. We successfully prevented many cases of exposure, malnutrition, dehydration, health consequences due to lack of hygiene, and catastrophic mental health consequences through this epic act of mutual aid. Why stop there? Unhoused people still need access to these critical resources. My hope is that this new awareness can open our hearts to those who have been living without for years. We must respond, organize, and create systems, whether governmental or social, to ensure every person is accounted for and these basic needs are met, or the homeless crisis will only worsen. May we take our experiences from this disaster and empower ourselves to advocacy and action that will allow unhoused people the same peace that was restored to us so quickly. I know we can do this, but we have a choice. Will we end the suffering for everyone, or just let ourselves take what we need and let things get, quote, back to normal, unquote? What kind of community do you want to live in? And that's hand in hand. What if we responded to homelessness like we responded to Hurricane Helene, by Henry, in the spring 2025 issue of the Slingshot magazine, which is freely distributed. You can get it, I think, at the info shop in Berkeley on Shattuck Avenue. 3124 Shattuck Avenue, to be exact, according to the second page of their paper. And here's another story that caught my eye. It's not, the word homeless does not appear in it. It's not about Santa Cruz. I don't usually go this far afield. But it talked about a situation that I was really unaware of, and it had to do with South Africa. And it is true, it does talk about the behavior of leaders, heads of state, that are usually given far, far too much attention Trump most particularly. This story is called Trump Never Wanted a Deal with South Africa White House Meeting. It's in the San Jose Mercury News for May 27, 2025, and it's by Lydia Polgreen, who I am embarrassed to admit it, is a New York Times columnist. I don't think much of the New York Times these days, but I'm going to read a bit of it now. It might sound improbable in light of the bizarre encounter that unfolded in the Oval Office on Wednesday, but President Donald Trump and Cyril Ramaphosa, South Africa's president, actually have quite a few things in common. Both are lavishly wealthy business tycoons who coveted, then achieved, rather late in life, the highest office in their land. Both share a taste for the refined leisure of the moneyed global elite, golf for Trump, fly fishing for Ramaphosa. But most important, both built their formidable reputations on a knack for making deals. In Trump's case, this usually involved real estate, hotels, casinos, luxury condominiums. Ramaphosa, for his part, was central to one of the most celebrated deals of the 20th century. He was the lead negotiator in the talks that brought an end to apartheid in South Africa. Ramaphosa and his party, the African National Congress, achieved this remarkable feat in no small part through his uncommon knack for finding common ground and a willingness to make hard choices and big sacrifices to achieve peace with a sworn enemy. Sure, Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk, leaders of their respective parties, got the Nobel Peace Prize. But Ramaphosa, relentless and charming in equal measure, played a critical role in getting the deal over the finish line. Spectacle, not statecraft. So it is perhaps not surprising that Ramaphosa, a debonair statesman who does not lack confidence in his abilities, thought he could bring his considerable talents to the Oval Office and at least begin the process of making some kind of deal with a man who thinks of himself as the king of deals. Instead, Trump hijacked the meeting to focus on a racist fantasy of white South Africans suffering genocide at the hands of a black majority. A spectacle, it was grimly riveting. As statecraft, it was deeply damaging. It's not like there wasn't anything serious to talk about. The two countries are at odds over a range of issues: South Africa's genocide case against Israel, tariffs, aid cuts to the country's most vulnerable citizens, that would benefit from reasoned discussion. But Trump had clearly planned to ambush Ramaphosa, bringing in a television screen and dimming the lights to show a video of an opposition party leader, Julius Malema, leading a crowd in a chant, "Kill the Boer, kill the farmer," that Trump and his allies claim support their view that white people face genocidal violence in South Africa. It was, to say the least, misleading. Malema, a notorious gadfly and former leader of the youth wing of the African National Congress, was long ago expelled amid a storm of fights with the party's leaders. His party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, advocates the broad seizure and redistribution of white land without compensation, a policy that the ANC has long rejected. That's the African National Congress that Ramaphosa is the head of. Trump might point to the law that allows the government to seize the land, quote, for a public purpose or in the public interest, but the government so far has not done so without compensation. In the South Africa of the Trumpist fever dream, in which a bloodthirsty black majority seeks vengeance against whites by taking their land and even their lives, EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters, would be wildly popular. But in the last year's general election and the real South Africa, it was in some ways the biggest loser, slipping from third to fourth largest party in parliament. Indeed, the white landowner is no longer a reliable political boogeyman. When I went to South Africa to report on the election last May, I found that the real xenophobic rage driving politics was directed primarily at poor migrants from other African countries who have become convenient scapegoats for the intractable inequality that has long defined South Africa. I heard plenty of complaints about Somali shopkeepers supposedly gouging the residents of poor townships outside Cape Town, but hardly a peep about the wealthy Afrikaner families that control vast swaths of rich farmland just a few miles away. This is a remarkable turnabout, but its roots lie in the vaunted deal that Ramaphosa helped make to end apartheid. The white minority that had subjugated and ruled the black majority after expropriating their land, herding them into poor Bantustans, and profiting from their cheap labor would yield to democracy and a new constitution that would grant the right to vote to all South Africans. In exchange for political power, the fundamental economic arrangements that had concentrated virtually all of the country's wealth in white hands would remain largely unchanged. There would be no expropriation of land, no forced divestment. A small black elite would get a seat at the corporate South African table, Ramaphosa among them. A small black middle class would emerge at the edges of that elite. But the fundamental inequality baked in by apartheid, a tiny sliver of mostly white people holding the vast majority of land and wealth, would endure. A report published in the World Bank Economic Review that examined wealth distribution in South Africa from the end of apartheid to 2017, and that it ended in about 1992, I believe, found that the top 10% of the country controls 86% of its wealth, an astonishing gap. Perhaps this explains why Ramaphosa's party, which had employed overwhelming support from voters since the end of apartheid in 1994, I may be corrected on that, finally lost its majority last year. But when faced with the choice of coalition partners to build a government, Ramaphosa shunned radical parties like the Economic Freedom Fighters, with their chants about killing farmers, and formed a coalition government with its arch rival, the Democratic Alliance, a party deeply associated with white wealth. Members of that party were among the mixed-race delegation that made the trip to the White House on Wednesday, composed of politicians from Ramaphosa's uneasy coalition government, and rounded out by a pair of famous golfers and South Africa's richest man. Fake evidence. Multiple white members of the delegation from South Africa tried to persuade Trump that his fears of white genocide were misplaced, that violent crime is a problem that affects all South Africans. Trump, theatrically waving around fake evidence of a fake problem, was unmoved. He wasn't there to make a deal. He was there to make memes and score points with his most rabid fans. Through all of Trump's lies and bluster, Ramaphosa remained remarkably composed. At the end of the meeting, he reminded his counterpart that later this year, South Africa would play host to the Group of 20 and said he hoped Trump would attend. It was a telling reminder that the world is changing fast. Together, the G20 countries represent 80% of the global population and produce more than 85% of the world's economic output. They will play a critical role in shaping whatever new world order emerges from this fractious era. If the United States is an unreliable partner and a source of chaos, these countries will turn elsewhere, building new security and trade alliances that don't depend on the inconstant waning superpower. And in November, they'll all be in South Africa. It is folly to abandon America's seat at that table, but then folly seems more than anything to be Trump's stock in trade. It's an article by Lydia Polgreen of the New York Times called "Trump Never Wanted a Deal with South Africa," reprinted in the Mercury News. Now, I'm always wary of mainstream Democratic Party attacks on Trump, not because I don't think Trump isn't completely full of shit, similar to the way that Biden and Harris are, and so the Democratic Party generally is, as well as the Republicans. These are little elite parties that have nothing to do with ordinary people, but manipulate them regularly. Manipulate us regularly, I should say. Still, there are some interesting claims about South Africa and its current government under Ramaphosa's American National Congress. and the folks he's doing coalitions with and the folks he's rejecting. So I thought I would educate myself, and who knows, maybe educate you folks out there if you're listening to this and didn't know about this. But let's let David Rovix educate you with a little more musical flair. Rovix writes, Omid Masarmali immolates himself on the island of Nauru in an Australian internment camp. And here's his song, Layla and Majnun.
In the years following the Woomera breakout in Australia in 2002, the focus for the government on detaining refugees moved from remote areas of the outback to islands like Nauru. The cynicism involved with this new phase of the long-standing stop-the-boats policies advocated by both ruling parties there would be hard to overstate. Nauru is one of the world's smallest nations in every sense. It's basically a depleted phosphate mine, a devastated environment with a few thousand impoverished locals and an Australian detention camp. But because it is nominally an independent country, it can have its own unique policies for immigration and visitation, etc. While most countries in the world think tourism is a good thing, the government of Nauru doesn't want any, so a visa to visit the island nation costs $6,000. This obviously keeps out the protesters, the journalists, and everyone else. The refugees being housed there are ostensibly free. That is, they are technically not imprisoned. It's just that all of Nauru is a prison. So if they want to go anywhere else, they need to have a visa to another country. If they're from a war-torn country or a country they can't return to for some other reason, they probably have no other real option but to return home and risk whatever faces them there, or stay in Nauru. To be clear, these are refugees who have been given refugee status by the United Nations. But Australia has found a way around the Geneva Conventions with the Phosphate Island. Given such a dismal reality, the refugees detained in Nauru are generally miserable and desperate. In April 2016, one young man from Iran named Omid Masarmali became another victim of Australian policies. Layla and Majnun is an ancient Persian poem and tells a story that bears striking similarities to the love story of Omid and his partner, and the life they couldn't have together, not because of unsympathetic parents, as in the poem, but because of Australian xenophobia. Layla met Majnun, it was at a traffic light. He handed her his number at first sight. It all happened very quickly. Soon both of them were aware that life can be so good when it's shared. When Layla met Majnun, it was convenient, it would seem, that both of them were living in the city of their dreams. They had no plan to leave and lots of plans to stay, but one day that all changed and they had to go away. So Layla and Majnun together left the country. They got on a crowded boat, sailed the Pacific Sea. They were headed to Australia, a place they thought they knew. Then the Australian Navy took them to Nauru, where Layla and Majnun were kept there in detention on a tiny little island, run just like a prison, where they were told by immigration, dream all that you can, but your only pathway off this island is on a boat back to Iran. Thank you.
Layla and Majnun, amid the heat and damp, tried to make best of life in a prison camp. But the strongest of foundations eventually will shake, and the strongest of hearts eventually will break. Layla and Majnun were on the island when one day there came some visitors from the UN. The next thing Layla knew, she was witness to the scene of her beloved doused in gasoline. Layla saw Majnun in a state no one should be in, bright flames rising, burning off his skin. Sometimes you can reach a point so beaten down, so tired, the only option that seems left is to set yourself on fire. When Layla met Majnun,
so now it's back to the streets on Saturday, yesterday if you're listening to this on Sunday, June 1st, at the Food Not Bombs meal, which had moved from the town clock over to the post office because there was a protest or a celebration, I'm not sure which, combination of the two perhaps, around LGBTQ folks who are at the town clock themselves. Food Not Bombs has always been quite responsive to allowing the space that it uses on weekends usually to feed folks who are hungry and clarify what their message is, which is food, not bombs, or food, not bureaucrats, as some may say it. But they're also willing to understand that this is a public space that has to be shared. And anyway, here's some voices from the outskirts of the meal and the sides of the sidewalk.
So, I'm talking with...
My name's Kelly Kassman.
Kelly, I'm Robert. Today's 31st of May, and it's about, I don't know, nearly two. How long have you been in town?
I've been here over, like, 13 years, and been struggling, you know, on and off the streets, trying to get help from the, you know, Housing Matters and whoever can help me, and it just doesn't seem to happen.
And the last contact you had with, I call them Funding Matters myself. How did that go? What happened?
Last week, I've been trying to get into the loft or somewhere. I've been assaulted on the street by somebody. I have a stalker. I don't feel safe, and they're not helping me to do anything.
And you spoke to them. What was their reaction? What did they say?
Basically, they said, we'll look into it and see what we can do. And, you know, when I go and
we'll
check back...
We'll contact you next year sometime.
Yeah, when I go and check back, they go, oh, well, we had some openings, but they're all taken now. And I was like, well, I already talked to you about this. How come you didn't reach out to me? Oh, it was, you know, they make up...
Did you have a phone contact or anything yourself?
I had a way for them to contact me, yeah. Yeah.
And you had a phone number that worked, which
yeah.
Sometimes hard, I know.
Sometimes I do lose my stuff, or it's stolen from me, so I'm constantly having stuff stolen from me, so it's hard to keep a phone, yes. But I have an email, and I check things, and I go there and check periodically. And so right now, I've been told that they're going to be housing people that live on Coral Street. Supposedly, they're going to have a hotel, but nothing's ever been mentioned to anybody, or you know, they've told us, but... They don't. When I ask about it, nothing's even mentioned about it. So, I just think they're full of crap. You know,
well, they need more offices. You know, to process these applications.
They need more people that are gonna steal the money. You know, and still work for them. That's happening.
It's a money-making operation.
Yeah, embezzling and then still working. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Have you used them in the past with any success at all?
No. We lived in a pallet, and we had issues with the security pepper spraying us for no apparent reason, because we were in someone else's pallet. It was really stupid. And what was it? Oh, yeah, visiting a friend. And the guy had issues with him for showering at night, because he had, sometimes that you, if you have an issue and you need to shower at night, you ask and it's okay. But it turned into now him being, well, my boyfriend being, they're trying to get him for battery, because they pepper sprayed us and I gave him a bottle of Gatorade, and he emptied it and then threw it down and it hit the security guard.
It ricocheted.
Yeah. And they're trying to get him for battery right now.
How long ago was that?
Over a year, 2 years almost now. We've been waiting for this, so.
And it's still active in the courts?
Yeah. And then they didn't help me find housing because I was...
You're nodding.
Yeah. I was working at the time when we were in the pallets, and they couldn't help me then. Now I'm not working, and they can't help me. I need to be working. So it doesn't matter what I'm doing. I'm watching all these people get into housing after me, and I'm a local. I was born here, and I can't get help here. But everyone and their mom can make up stories about things happening to them, and they get help, and I tell the truth, and I don't get help.
Who was the person who pepper sprayed?
I can't remember the security guard's name, but he doesn't work there anymore. He got a raise for doing that, too.
Really?
Yeah, he became like the head security guard.
Well, he's very proficient.
Very.
How much of the 13 years have you been outside?
Pretty much close to that.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
How has the city changed? Do you mind if I sit down?
No, go ahead.
I'm just wondering how the... Thank you.
How has the city changed?
In terms of how it's treated folks outside. Is there...
Oh, it's terrible out here. I mean, the cops are terrible, of course. They've always not really been that helpful. I mean, in the past, I remember I had $9,000 in charges for camping. So I got that down to $450, paid it, but then it shows that I didn't pay it. So, you know, we were actually paid to get, and got off the streets for a couple of years ourselves. We got off the streets, we were working for the county and
what kind of work?
We worked, during COVID, I worked at the vets hall, and we also worked with the homeless youth. So we were in the position that a lot of these people are in, so I know what goes on there, you know. A lot of the donations that were given, the people that worked there got first dibs before the people that needed the stuff did. Just people just, they're very selfish, and they don't really care. And someone told me that Take Back Santa Cruz owns Housing Matters now. So I don't, or as of a year ago, so I don't know if that's the truth or not.
I don't either.
So I have to look into that. But
if you learn more, I'd be curious.
Yeah, because it seems like the people that work at the shelter, if you do care there, if at Housing Matters, then they get fired. You know,
Do you know particular people have been fired because of this?
I know one particular person that I don't know her name. She comes around, and she actually, I haven't seen her for a little while, but they made up lies about her, and yeah. I know one particular person that's happened to, and they are, they're just mean, they're heartless. They can put me out on the street after I've been abused and had all these things happen, and they say, well, sorry, we can't help you, oh, we're going to make an exception, and you can keep your stuff in our storage for as long as you need to, and then I come and I check, and it's been thrown away, like all of my stuff thrown away, and it's just really ridiculous, and I've seen a lot of people able to stay at the shelter for years, and I don't know how they're doing that or why. What, you know, are they, what are they doing to be able to stay there for years? That's not how it works. It's a 6-month program, and then you're out.
That's what I've heard anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, so, and with the armory, it's terrible up there. They,
when was the last time you were there?
How about, was it over 6 months ago? Over 6 months ago. We lived up there for a little while. We were...
When it was under People First or under the Salvation
the
Army?
New people. Yeah, they're the same people there. It's just a different name. But they threw away his dad's ashes.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And he called about it, and then the information didn't get through the people. They said they just threw away some food boxes and other stuff, but really they threw away his dad's ashes, and there's nothing we could do about that. You know, it's pretty...
They've done it to multiple people.
Mm-hmm.
They've done it to multiple people, you say?
Yeah, they've thrown away their family members' ashes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And nothing...
Like, I know of like 4 or 5 people that they've done that to.
Yeah, yeah, and if when you... Yeah.
What do they say when you confront them with that?
Say They don't do anything about it.
They have no, like, you talk to somebody on the phone, and they're like, they assure you everything's okay, and, like, the message will get, you know, but they don't communicate with each other, you know? Mm-hmm. They don't, there's no communication going on, there's a lack of training, you know? Obviously, people are just going in there and mindlessly, like, just tossing stuff in the trash. It's, you know, it's people's property and important things, you know?
How long were you there for?
Three months.
How long did it take you to get in, if at all?
Not very long, because of the fact that I work for the county, they kind of expedited it and put me in there, or put us in there to help us out.
How long had you worked for the county?
For a year. Yeah, for the year. And the other thing is that when you have a grievance or some kind of issue, there's nothing's ever settled. You can file a grievance and about something, and they don't ever get back to you. And then you file another one, and they don't get back to you. So it's like there's no resolution to any of your problems. You just keep having more problems and more problems. And, you know, and there's nothing you can do. There's literally nothing you can do. You just, with anything, you just complain about it, whatever, rant and rave, and then that's it. They win in the end, you know. They take your stuff and throw it away, even though they're supposed to hold on to it for a certain amount of days.
What have you lost there?
Everything. All of my stuff.
An example would be?
My clothing, shoes, photos, sleeping bags, pillows, his dad's ashes, prescription medications, toiletries. Just artwork, all of our artwork and stuff.
What kind of artwork do you do?
He does a lot of cartooning. Like, was it lowbrow? Yeah.
Cartoons.
What is a lowbrow cartoon?
It's just different kinds of cartoons. It could be, there's a lot of, it's like a music culture, it's like the punk rock stuff.
Are you any good at caricatures?
Yeah, for sure.
Because I don't do it now, but I'd like to, I'll show you some of the flyers I write, which have to do with lack of civil rights for people on the street. Not that that does any good, mind you, but still, you know, I just keep, when I write these, raising the issues, and also showing the city, what the Santa Cruz, I call them the shitty council, they're the city council, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but they are completely unresponsive to basic needs of people here,
yeah.
Or significantly unresponsive. They most of the money goes into situations that don't get directly to homeless people, and there's a huge amount, and most people, I don't know if it's a majority, but a large number of people are still outside. They would like to get housed. They would like to get sheltered reasonably. I would think, I have a poll here, which if you want, you can fill out. It's not that it necessarily goes anywhere. I have the same problem of disorganization that maybe Morrison, who runs this People First thing, Evan Morrison.
Yeah, I know it,
yeah. He has. I mean, he's very amiable and talks nice to us, but we don't get the details that we need to know as to how many people are being kicked out for what. What's the process by which a person can appeal? Why can't people get visitors in their tents?
People are totally just getting booted out of their places, like,
yeah,
left and right.
They put them in somewhere, and they're treated like criminals right from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
They can't have anybody come over. It's frowned upon. And
it's like a prison.
They set them up, and they take their deposit, or when they take that money, they kick them out, and then
thank you.
That's it, you know, that's it. Then some people, you know, they're able to get another place to live, but, you know, it's a constant failure. You're meant to fail. You know, how is it that someone that's been homeless finally gets to go indoors and they can't have anybody over, their family, anybody over at past 5 o'clock or even during the day?
Thank
some
you.
Places don't let you have them during the day. So, you know, we're all human beings and we all need to be treated like that. You know, no one's better than other, you know, some people have had circumstances that have, you know, occurred that have been in this situation, and they've lived a life where they've been at a job and had children or grandchildren, and you know, it's like there's no peace and comfort out here at all. It's just really horrific. There's a lot of evil going on out here, and there's not much I can do about it, you know?
How are women treated outside, would you say?
Oh, gosh. They're sexual, you know, people, they just are like sexual creatures, you know, looked upon by men, women. I mean, there's a lot of human trafficking, there's a lot of crazy shit going on that people just don't know about. And women, it's hard for us. It's really hard for us. I refuse to give up, you know.
Good.
Just try to keep working, and I'm a caregiver, so, you know, it doesn't always work out good in the end, because, you know, it's hard to deal with elderly people that aren't all there, you know, because they're in their 80s and they're sick and they can't remember things, and their families just think that I'm, you know.
They want to wash their hands of them.
Yeah.
Or they just don't have the financial resources.
They want their family member to die so they can have money, and then I help them live longer. So it's like...
Yeah, what do you mean by doing that, anyway?
By making their life a better place. To, you know, I help them be around people again. You know, there's one lady I took care of. She couldn't communicate. She stopped having a hard time communicating. By me being around her, she started being able to communicate. And then I basically prepare them for passing on to the next phase of their life.
Now, was this a paid job, or were you a volunteer?
I was a paid job. I have my own business.
What was it called?
It's Cloud Nine Caregiving.
And
I still
long,
have it.
How long are you still doing it?
I still have it, yeah. I was just working for someone, and I didn't take any money for it. And he's in intensive care right now. But I saved his life for a while, saved his leg. There's a lot of elder abuse going on, where a lot of people are caregiving and they're not taking care of them at all. This man, I don't think had showered in who knows how long, had staph, turned into MRSA, had an ulcer on his leg, MRSA ulcer, whatever, and just, it was terrible. Got him into the hospital and he left against the doctor's recommendations, and now he's... Finally, his son came into town the other day and took him to the hospital, and he didn't come home from the hospital, and now he's in intensive care. So, and of course, we're getting blamed for the issues with his dad, but he was not there. So, you know, we step into situations, as me as a caregiver, where it's not pretty. You know, that's a lot of these people have dementia, and their families don't want anything to do with them, and so I just come in, I care about people, regardless of where they're at in their life, and I just show them a lot of love and caring, and I can, at the end of the day, I know that I'm a good person, and I did the best that I could do.
Back to Kelly and John in a moment, but first, here's a David Rovics break. The next Rovics song is introduced in the following way. Jeremy Corbyn is elected leader of the British Labour Party, and the song is I Agree with Jeremy.
Late 2015 and early 2016 were heady times and horrifying times, depending, and this was simultaneously the case on both sides of the Atlantic. In the U.S., we watched as the Democratic Party leadership sabotaged Bernie Sanders' campaign for president in favor of the preferred candidate of capitalism and empire. In the U.K., we watched as the British Labour Party grew massively, gaining hundreds of thousands of new members, and the most popular and most left-wing and the only directly elected leader the party had ever had, in the form of Jeremy Corbyn. And then we watched as the Labour Party eviscerated itself, purging most of itself of most of its best members, successfully turning itself back into the party of business that it had been prior to Jeremy Corbyn's election in September 2015. If you travel around Europe today, you'll find society stratified. You'll find an ever-widening political divide. You'll find a growing left and a right that's growing faster, convincing people they're the ones to avert the next disaster. You can see the dark clouds growing, taking over every space, except oddly enough, in a little place called England, where a growing chorus screams, I agree.
treated him like a clown. Transnational corporations said this man will bring us down. The Blairites in the party stabbed him in the back, and then they did it again. But after each attack, he was steady at the helm, at the job for which he was picked. Despite all the accusations, he's an anti-Zionist peacenik who wants to change the country, and says the country, I agree with Jeremy. Most members of the parliament wish he'd go away, but as their elected leader, he's set to stay. And when he supports a candidate, they usually tend to win, which makes the Blairites fume while the rest of us just grin. Between the BBC, the Tories, and all the corporate MPs, the tabloid press, the IMF, and all the landed gentry, they're pulling out the stops to stop the ascendancy of I agree with Jeremy. The one that we all face. What direction now goes this human race? Do we give up on the missiles and tax the rich a lot, or give up on society and just embrace the rot? Among us, who would tell us it's the foreigners to blame, not the Blairite Tory billionaires and their rigged neoliberal game? Each day the numbers grow, as each day new people see that they agree with Jeremy. I agree with Jeremy.
That makes me happy, so.
How is Food Not Bombs treating you?
They've been good so far. I don't have any issues with them. The food's good, and, you know, they seem to be pretty pleasant, so. Yeah, I don't have too much to say about them.
Did you ever use Brent's services out on Felker Street when they were available the last couple of years? It's near Denny's at the end of that street. He had, you know,
the
clothing.
There. It's like a church type. They had the storage.
But, yeah, yeah. They had a women's deal as well, I believe.
No, I never. We got into an apartment for a few years, so we didn't use it. And we had a car for a while. And I haven't really used a lot of services because I'm constantly just pushed away. I just get treated.
Not a fan of the service.
No, I mean it's not the service. I mean I used their storage. That was it. But I never got involved with any of the women's stuff. Maybe I should have checked it out. I don't know. I just a lot of women are very nice to each other, so. I don't really hang around a lot of women out here. I find that they're really mean, and it just turns ugly, so I just kind of stick to myself most of the time.
Would you like to fill out a poll about problems with the armory and or other services? I've got I may have a couple copies. I got
to
take a look here.
I'll get you.
And we've been talking with...
Kelly.
And what's your name, sir, if you wish? John, Robert here. Yeah.
Yeah, we're just, you know, I actually got chosen to be a lived experience to the city council and the police and all that. And I made a speech and so, you know, people know that's how I kind of got into the loft quickly. Because I had a worker and then I was trying to reach her. And then I spoke with Evan, and I told her, hey, I can't get a hold of my worker. And then she said, oh, well, she doesn't work here anymore. I was like, okay. That's kind of crappy. You don't tell people that people have quit or left.
What's the name of the worker?
I can't remember her name right now. Christine, no, that's the new one. I can't remember her name right now. Okay. Over the last few years, my brain, my memories, I a lot of... A lot of trauma and stuff. I just can't remember a lot of names and stuff that well. But yeah. So Brian, she had Brian Sands, I think is his last name. I don't know his name's Brian, but one of the workers. He helped me get into the pallets. So
pallets being the housing matter.
Mm-hmm. And so that worked out. for a while, but...
How do Housing Matters treat the people on the Coral Street who are in tents outside the entrance?
They're okay for the most part. I don't like the way a lot of security guards treat us. They're just mean. And they, you know, they're heartless. I mean, there's some people that are okay, yeah, we have food, but they're out of it a lot of the time. They have clothing, but most of the time people are too lazy to go look and see what it is, and they have really nice stuff that they put in one area and another thing. So it's all about, the, you know, if their boss is going to let them do it or not. You know, they don't have a lot of say. Just working there, they're just puppets, you know, from the leaders or whoever tell them what to do, and they really don't care. They really don't care much. I don't see them, you know, doing anything other than what they're told to do. So I was grateful to be able to do that and get my, you know, I made everyone realize, hey, we're all just human beings and we need to treat each other kindly, because you never know if something's going to happen, you're going to end up in the same situation.
I've been talking with again.
Kelly.
And John. Let me give you the goods here, whatever I've got.
So Kelly filled out a form that I passed on to her called People First Armory Poll, a view from the inside, and she sort of specified how long she'd been there, and again reiterated some of the things she said in that interview, that one of her main concerns was a failure to have other people being able to visit each other in their tents, and presumably having her partner to being able to be there with her. She had to left and entered a worse situation on the streets, and suggested different policies the armory might use, particularly around the visitors policy. Let's take a musical break and we'll go back to interviews. And Rovick's next song is preceded by this particular sentence: Donald Trump launches a campaign for the U.S. presidency and wins. The name of the song, Make the Planet Earth Great Again.
Meanwhile in the U.S., the only candidate who might have beaten Trump, according to the polls, Bernie Sanders, had his campaign sabotaged by the party whose members were electing him in state after state as their candidate. So then the man who came down his golden escalator in Manhattan became president. The phenomena at work here are vitally important to understand. One is that when the left doesn't have a viable alternative to problems people are facing, many will turn to the right for solutions. Another is that for the liberals, for the types of apologists for capitalism and imperialism who have long been running the Democratic Party in the U.S. or the Labour Party in the U.K., it is always preferable to have a fascist in power than a socialist. If the candidate your own party seems to be offering up is too far to the left, it's always better to stab them in the back and support the right's candidate. This is how Trump came to power. The big orange baby had a midwife, and the midwife's name is the Democratic National Committee.
We can tackle the economy first. Get rid of all the billionaires. Set the system up so that instead of hoarding, people share. Make housing, food, and healthcare basic human rights around the world for everyone is how we'd set our sights. If we could get to that point, I could say that then we could make the planet Earth great again. With human rights around the world, there'd be no refugees, no safeguarding your homeland from terrorists overseas, no need for a border wall, no jobs to protect. With a global basic income established, it's simple and direct. Free trade, fair trade, same damn thing. We get to that point, then we can make the planet Earth great again. We could take on other issues like the survival of our race, by which I mean the bipeds on this floating rock in space, the most invasive species anywhere around, the one that keeps on burning everything that can be found, the one that will get it together in the nick of time, and then make the planet Earth great again. We can stop spending money on antiquated technology, such as tanks and missiles and most other things military. We can use those vast resources to make us all safe and sound. Windmills in the air, coal and oil in the ground. We can be the envy of the rest of the galaxy when we make the planet Earth great again. We make the planet Earth great again. We make the planet Earth great again.
We're talking to a veteran of olden time. What's your name again, sir?
Bill Bear.
Mr. Bear. And Phil, you, in the olden times, you were a lot involved in organizing in the Beach Flats, but age has wearied you.
I suppose so. I'm on to other issues.
What are you up to now?
I'm pretty pro-Palestinian.
I would hope so.
I'm pretty anti-war in Ukraine.
That would be nice.
That's a real stupid one. And, of course, I'm anti-U.S. government.
Oh, now.
But I'm a loyal radical.
You're a loyal.
No, I'm a disloyal radical.
Disloyal radical.
As disloyal as I dare to be, which is not very disloyal because I'm a bit of a coward.
Well, me too.
It gets scary out there,
yeah.
No doubt. Last little incident I witnessed was that crushing of the encampment up at UCSC.
Last spring.
That was ugly and brutal and successful. Squashed that movement like a pancake.
Anything new brewing that you've seen?
Hints of it, but I keep looking for it. The pro-Palestinian thing is underground, sort of, and I'm not even that closely in touch with it, but on the actual international scene, I hear certain vaguely encouraging hints, but I'm a dreamer, so I could be wrong. I could be imagining it all.
Trump says this and Trump says that and so forth.
Yeah, no, it's hard to know what is going on anywhere, including right here.
Originally, I was suggesting, I'm curious if you have any sense of whether anything had ever happened with that Nueva Vista project, which used to be called Dolphin Lee.
It's all up and running. Mercy housing, affordable. They blend in. I fought it at the time, like I fought a number of things.
As did I.
Unsuccessfully, and they came into existence, and I've adjusted, and they aren't as bad as I was anticipating, so...
Did people actually get housing guarantees, the ones who were driven out of the apartments?
I couldn't follow it that closely. They got something by way of a guarantee. How solid it was and whether or not it really worked for them, I couldn't do enough follow-up to really check out the results. I know all of those people, or the vast majority of those people, are no longer around, you know, so if they got housing, it wasn't anywhere close to the flat.
Mississippi, perhaps.
Mississippi, lovely this time of year.
Warmer, I would say.
Warmer, yeah. You like
more humid
thing. No, I'll stay here.
How's Jane doing?
Deceased. My sad tragedy.
How long ago?
Coming on 9 years now. We've been out of touch for a while.
I never heard of it.
Yeah. No, it's just my life is good other than for that.
You're smiling.
So when you don't have a sleep,
yes, of course, because my life is good. Other than that, I can exist.
You got a roof over your head.
A roof over my head. A lot of family members who are doing fair to middling, and sometimes even good. So I feel very fortunate indeed.
You're just coming from the post office? I take it you didn't come?
No,
come
I'm
to
just
Food
wandering
Bombs here.
Around, checking the scene out.
Well, and you see what you found. I found you. You found me.
Oh, you are the scene.
I am.
That's what everybody says.
Seen and sometimes not even heard.
Right, and sometimes obscene.
Hopefully, occasionally.
Yeah, keep trying. You can do it.
And we have been talking with?
Phil.
Phil Bear, of course.
Yeah, right.
We haven't seen your face at City Council recently.
I haven't been to a City Council meeting in decades. I don't think I'd recognize anybody. I just don't have any issues where I would hold out even a glimmer of hope that that City Council would do anything. Last time I was there was trying to persuade the council to do something and make some sort of a statement about the Palestinian thing, and it fell flat on its face.
A year and a half ago,
yeah, right.
A huge line that went around the block, or at least to the sidewalk.
And I think we got Sandy Brown as a minority of one against a city council that said no.
Fred Keeley told us he couldn't call it a genocide.
Yeah, right. Well, Fred isn't very good on that particular subject.
On many subjects, I found.
You could say that.
I do. Thanks, Phil.
See you, Robert.
Next, David Rovix writes, thousands of people travel from all over to protest the pipeline being put through the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota. This is the beginning of his history between 2016 and 2020. All of it available online, by the way. Just look up Musical History with David Rovix.
The final year of the Obama presidency saw thousands of people from all over North America converge in North Dakota in support of the Lakota people, who were opposing the building of the gas pipeline that eventually was built, in spite of all the opposition. For so many of the people who came from everywhere, dropping everything to camp out in the snow and protest against the building of the pipeline, often involving riot police firing water cannon in freezing temperatures, the experience altogether was a life-defining one. Many of my friends from activist circles from all over went to Standing Rock in the winter of 2016. If I weren't occupied looking after a newborn baby at the time, I would likely have joined them there, but I only got as far as writing a song.
After all the westerns, after all the lies, after making every effort to deny that history is happening, that it isn't in the past, that the Indian Wars continue, that Ishii was not the last. After building all the pipelines, after spraying all the gas, after desecrating graveyards, being told they shall not pass, after shooting all the horses, after driving in with tanks, after sending in the dogs, with soldiers in their ranks, they're standing up at Standing Rock. After all the fire water, after all the famine, after killing all the buffalo, after taking all the salmon, after taking all the water to slurry all the coal, after mining the uranium from a million giant holes, after stealing and lynching, shooting people as they dance, after trying hard to make sure there'd be no second chance, after declaring Indian country one big sacrifice zone, at no point ever trying to acknowledge or atone, they're standing up at Standing Rock. After all the cities ransacked, after all the cities burned, after all the centuries when almost no one even learned that these towns ever existed, up and down the coast, up and down the Mississippi, leaving colonists to boast this land is our land now, a new homeland for the white, after all the missionaries taking children in the night, after all the slaughter, after centuries of theft, watch the people rioting to defend what's left, they're standing up at Standing Rock.
They're standing up at Standing Rock.
I'm talking with
Scott.
And Scott, you're a man drinking coffee. Is this dog related to you?
Yes, she is. Chuck Shepherd.
What is the name of this dog?
Betsy.
Betsy.
Yes.
And are you yourself an outside man who lives or is outside when he sleeps at night?
Yeah, outside.
And how does it treat you?
I guess pretty good. I mean, you can make it if you want to make it or whatever, or with some up and downs, we have a chance of getting robbed. Already been robbed a couple times, my backpack and stuff, and it's more or less like keep your enemies close, you know. So,
how are the police treating you?
I only interacted with them one time, and that's when I first got in town. I'm from here. I was born here. I grew up in Bonny Doon, and when I first got here that weekend, I went to the clock tower and ate, and then I spent the night there and I got a ticket for
camping, perhaps?
Yeah.
Illegally sleeping in a public place?
Yes, sir.
Unlawful lodging, perhaps?
Yes, exactly. By the way.
My goodness, you know, I'm talking to a known criminal.
I know, it's a $280 ticket.
What did you do with that ticket?
I haven't paid it yet.
Ah, dear.
Well, they told me it's only going to be 15, and then it somehow it turned out to be 280, but the thing is, there's other people camped out there, and I'm the only one who got a ticket, so.
Did they get tickets, too?
No.
Why did they choose you? A special honor of some kind?
I don't know. I didn't have a tent. I didn't have a sleeping bag. I just had, like, a tarp, and I just unfolded it and crawled underneath it, and me and my dog curled up inside of it, and that was that.
And did they let you continue to go back to sleep after ticketing you?
No, they said get out of here.
Did they give you a place to go?
No.
Did you tell them where to go?
I was afraid to.
Understandably. You
they had guns. I didn't really.
When they originally, you know, approached you with these flyers and this recorder, you said you might have some thoughts you wanted to give, and I told you I'm interested in experiences. But if you have something you wanted to say, feel free to say it.
I don't know. I've heard a lot of things about the homeless situation here. I mean, like I said, I'm from here, and 4 months ago, I couldn't even consider myself being in a situation. Never. Because I'm a dog trainer, and I've worked with several security. I get into the security end of it, you know, like law enforcement or whatever. And so, I mean, I got to try to continue my canine career. I've been here for 5 months. I'm not really impressed. And I go to Housing Matters and stuff, and they said they're heavily funded. They got, like, tons and tons of money. And I really don't see it cleaned up, not even remotely. Either they need more money. If there's no money, I say, fire up the printing machine and start printing some more money. So
they got $4 or $5 million this year. I don't know. I'm not quite sure where it all went. There's been some question about that for some of us.
I mean, they like Housing Matters. You go there, you know, you got your showers and all that. But that's just like a drop in a bucket. I mean, I've been trying to get housing and stuff, and I'm. Now they're trying to get me into like another tent city or like 1220 or the Armory. Not just like over 100 people at the Armory. I mean, I don't see why they just don't build a big ass motel somewhere, spend a couple hundred mil, and just if people want to lodge there, they can.
Or buy one, for that matter.
Or buy one. I mean, I'm sure they can buy a. You know, I mean, it's if you're going to nickel and dime it, that's where all the money goes. I mean, I just don't see it going anywhere good. You got the pallet houses in the back, and you got the loft, and then the armory, and that's about it. I mean, there's people. I've seen people come off the street and talk to these people, and they get housing like immediately. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm 61 years old, so I guess age doesn't matter. But I have to be.
But not a bad looking 61.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I take care of myself. I try, you know.
You are wearing dark glasses.
Yeah, I'm wearing dark glasses. But you can, I mean, you know, I see people show up here and I can see them get wrapped up into the narcotics use and the trade. And you see these young kids coming here, these young women, and I see them get exploited, you know. get them, you know, try to start partying with them and stuff, and next thing you know it, they're doing Fetty or fentanyl, and next thing you know it, they just disappear, and you're like, well, where'd they go, you know? So there's like a little underground, I feel that there's a underworld here that's structured to the criminal element, you know? That's just me. I mean, I could be wrong, so. But I see what I see. And the homelessness, I mean, there's people who like living out here like this, because they got their own little group and stuff, you know?
But it isn't your choice of life?
No,
Life of choice?
No, I don't. I don't. Like I said, 4 months ago, I wouldn't even consider doing this. So, I mean, and so I've been doing this for like 5 months now, and I'm getting kind of tired of it. I need to do a career change. Well, I'm going to get back to my career, my canine career, so I'm trying to do that. And like I said, I'm a dog trainer. People want dogs trained, but they just don't have the money. You know, so, like, but a lot of the people I talk to are the homeless people that have dogs. You know, they're out of control or whatever. Like, I can work with them, but I can't really do it like a full-time deal because I have to get paid too after, you know.
I think there are more dogs with homeless people than, I don't know, 6 months ago. It might be hard to judge, but...
Some of the places I've been, like I've been to Seattle, I've been to Fort Worth, and cause I do a lot of training, like urban tracking with different agencies and stuff, and I run the streets with the dog just to put them in different environments. And, I see a lot of homeless people with dogs. And the thing is, you talk to any one of them, and you always see them with these big pit bulls and bull terriers and all that, and the first thing, when you're talking to them, the first thing they say is, that's their security, that's their protection. So they feel, I mean, they treat these dogs like they're kids. I mean, you couldn't buy them off them. You can offer them $2,000 for their dog, and they'll turn it down. They just don't.
Companions.
Yeah, hardcore. I mean, it's
family animals.
Yeah, it's incredible. Oh, it's how they're attached to their animals.
Now, do you have a phone yourself?
No, I don't have any cell phone. I mean, I've gotten a couple of government phones already, and they're just shit. They only last like about a good 4 weeks. Then I just got one a week ago, and it won't even turn on no more. And it's brand new, so I just threw it away. Thanks, government. You know, considering the government, you know, they'll spend $5,000 for some paperweight or whatever, their excessive spending. We can't get iPhones or something, you know? So, you always see the public on the internet, oh, get your free phone and blah, blah, blah. Well, how come they don't pass them out? These guys right here.
Yeah, I saw they still have that. I'm not sure. I thought they were discontinuing it, but good. Although I don't know how long those last or how easily they are to charge or anything like that. But
yeah, they're shit. You gotta figure if it's from the government, you know. After 9/11, you have the Patriot Act kicked in, and so they're probably heavily monitored. So, since it's a government phone,
could be.
Probably good chance, because you get a lot of immigrants that come over during the Joe Biden administration. I don't know how many people got over here, millions, and then the thing is, you'll see them on TV, and a lot of these guys are like fighting age males from Venezuela who hate our lifestyle or who hate America. You know, they think they're government officials or puppets and stuff, and I don't know.
My government officials or puppet? Are you kidding?
Our government officials.
Our government officials. We've been talking with
Scott McVay.
Proud companion with
Betsy.
Betsy. Thank you, man.
Have a good day. Thank you.
You're welcome. Am I talking with
Piper?
And Piper, what are your thoughts?
The life insurance for the flood accident is still floating up at the in Santa Cruz, in the Pacific, you know, instead of the Delaware. So, yeah, the water's too high. You know, we still got away. So, street news is that, you know, we'll be okay. Somebody will take care of us.
And let's say the last week you've been outside pretty much.
I live in the nature most of the time. Yeah, it has a lot of talent in nature.
Are you indoors or outdoors?
I shelter what I can, but I don't have flood insurance right now.
Negative.
Okay. I'm just a life on the street. Yeah.
How's the food here?
It's very thought of and very properly associated.
Did you enjoy it?
Excuse me? For the survivors, yeah. Yeah, they're well-beings, yes, they help us out.
And how are the cops treating you, if you want to say?
like a coping skills, you know, learning coping skills, same thing that the cops do.
I'm having a little trouble hearing you, so I'm catching, I think the microphone is catching you more than me, so it's good. At least we hear, they'll hear what you're saying. Anything you want to conclude with, Piper?
No, just closing for the day is easier that way. Okay, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Provides a little liquid nourishment to a thirsty dog. Drew, any quick report of anything?
Quick report of anything? Well, today we served a wonderful, wonderful meal on the post office side of Water Street.
Because what indivisible
there
is?
There is a transgender rally and march happening. The rally is going to be in the 4 o'clock area at the clock, and then the march, I believe, commences at 6. So we were here and had a wonderful, wonderful meal. It was kind of interesting. Usually when we do the what we call the sidewalk cafe as opposed to the clock, people kind of breeze through. They make a few connections. They get a little bit to eat and go. But today, people really found it just being very homey over here. And people actually stayed and perched same way they do with the clock. You know, it was nice to see that can happen. Because that's always been one of our, you know, when the clock works for us, but that's always been one of the downsides. It doesn't seem like people really want to, you know, be a part of it for very long.
It's more exposed, I would say, here.
Well, okay, yeah, that could be one reason.
And not as shady.
Well, it's actually here, it's all very shady.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And, but it worked out very, very well. Had some really, really good food. In fact, we're still feeding at 3 o'clock and good stuff. Very, very good day.
What was the menu today?
What was the menu today? Today we had, we had wonderful donations from Adorable French Cafe, where we had ciabatta bread, both meat and vegetarian, and we had croquettes, both sweet dessert croquettes, you know, with apple and blueberry cheesecake.
Eggs Benedict, perhaps?
Savory ones that were spinach. And then we had incredible, incredible lentil stew. We had, looked like some sort of a fried saffron rice. We had stuffing. What else did we have? We had salad, grilled potatoes, fruit salad, wonderful, looked like a fruit cobbler for dessert. And there you go. I mean, that really, really kept people...
A little chocolate cake?
We didn't do much chocolate today.
Did any... What ran out first, food-wise?
What ran out first? Strangely enough, let me see. The stuffing is a very, very big... That's like real, real comfort food. Everybody, you know, when they hear that they're stuffing...
Dry stuffing or gravy with the stuffing?
It's dry. Yeah. It's a dry stuffing, but it's, you know, I guess it's made with the right amount of oil. You know, it seems very, very moist, and people love it. You know, it's the kind of, it's almost like, you know, like mashed potatoes and meatloaf. It's
now, you mentioned before the trans folks are having a celebration across the street. What's the situation with trans folks in the community you serve? How much have you heard that there's, it has been a national, of course, Trump-inspired hostility towards trans folks happening nationally, and in some states by law as well.
Right.
And California, I'm not sure. I don't know quite what the situation is. A lot of the cities like to say, "Oh, we're rainbow and all that sort of thing." But with how they actually treat people, may be a different thing. What's your sense from a report on the ground here?
I would say that if you spoke to any transgender person, they would feel that they're very, that they're ostracized and not comfortable in our community. We serve a very small percentage of transgender people, and hopefully they'll be at the rally today and marching on their behalf.
Is there much of a class barrier, do you think, here between people who are well-to-do bourgeois gay folk and people who are poor trans folk?
You know, I wouldn't know how to answer that. I wouldn't, to be honest.
I don't either. I mean, I've seen, I suspect it's true, but that's a prejudice of mine.
Uh-huh. But yeah, you know, I see a lot of people that are transgender, that are unhoused, that seem very emotionally, you know, that seem, you know, depressed, have emotional issues, and it could originate from family, from, you know, just not being accepted. And it's good that they, you know, that they can find us and each other, because this is what we're all about, you know, is community, communitarianism.
You were at Soupstock last week. How'd that go?
Soupstock was wonderful. It was very, very successful.
This was the Duck Pond 45th anniversary celebration, yeah, without a duck pond, actually.
Right, but it was
no ducks.
It was an incredible turnout and an incredible amount of food. I don't know how many people we served. We had a line that was 60 to 80 feet long for over an hour. We especially made a great deal of food, you know, for that occasion. And none of it went to waste. Everything that we put out was taken, and the bands were great, the music was great. It was a wonderful spirit. I have to get back to taking down right now.
You better get to it.
Okay.
Letting yourself be ambushed by me. You should be ashamed of yourself.
I already am.
Very good.
Thank you. Yeah.
Very good.
The next song is called Names and Addresses, and preceded by the comment, Grenville Tower burns in London, killing 72.
In June of 2017, 72 people lost their lives in London when the cladding that had been put up to make some of the project housing look nicer had turned out to be made of a highly flammable material and caught fire. The fire spread because there were no fire breaks set up for the cladding to stop at any point in its vertical rise. The new additions to the building, the generally bad maintenance of it, the lack of safety updates in more recent years, and the generally sad state of public services in England all contributed to the high death toll in the Grenfell Tower fire, which was yet another bloody illustration of the consequences of the workings of unregulated capitalism and a lack of effective governance in general, and oversight of industries in particular.
1 a.m. on a Wednesday morning, no one knew what was in store. The fire started, quickly spread, till it covered every floor. Stairwell blocked, no way out, smoke and fire all around. Parents grabbed their little babies, dropped them 10 floors to the ground. People cried to no avail. 24 stories tall, engulfed in flames. The fire ladders were just like toys, no use at all. There were no sprinklers, few smoke alarms, fire extinguisher out of date. All repairs, if ever done, always too little, too late. When they built Grenfell, they believed housing was a human right. But all that changed. Now if you're not rich, you should be kept out of sight. Out of sight, out of town, or wrapped up neatly. They don't look too bad. The residents had tried to warn the authorities for years and years, but all their letters, all their blog posts, all their calls fell on deaf ears. Council housing taking space, left to rot for by and by. It was Sunday, be turned to dust in the forward march to gentrify. And in the meantime, if people perish with their children in their laps, it's the price the market has to pay to house the poor in fire traps. If this were murder, if this were murder, this were murder.
So, to conclude this relatively abbreviated version of Bathrop Spears Broadsides, here's a snatch, a fairly lengthy snatch, from the last Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom meeting, which had what was to me a lot of tumultuous discussion and interjection, where people were reporting different things. It was called a loose cannons meeting because I alternate kind of pushing the agenda and, if not running the meeting, trying to run the meeting, usually just, I don't know, being a part of the meeting, each week, or each other week. And this was Athena's week. Athena's a Huff activist who's been particularly active in People's Aid, a group that I'm not sure how active it still is, but it when she has time, she's also a regular worker for survival purposes and rent purposes and so forth. And so it's time has taken up with that kind of stuff. Anyway, I'll be interrupting a bit, but I'm having both technical problems doing this show, as I've mentioned before, and also staying on top of stuff that was happening in the meeting and getting pretty frustrated myself. But I think a lot of what came out was still of interest both to the folks at the meeting and anybody listening to it and concerned about the issues, the abusive police sweeps, the seizure of property, the difficulty of communications between homeless folks and those who are more housed and more helpful or want to be more helpful, but they have the problem of time and their own restrictions. I mean, my objective has been to set up this kind of phone, not so much a phone tree, but a phone system that could eventually gather documentation of incidents that will ultimately interest attorneys so that there can be a effective, if not an attempted lawsuit around this in Santa Cruz. Some of which have been successful in the past with the help of the COVID crisis and the help of a lot of activism in the community when police essentially were driven from the, or blacked from harassing people in the benchlands and the duck pond area when there was a duck pond in San Lorenzo Park in the winter of 2020. And that lasted for a number of years, a successful injunction. The injunction itself only lasted for about 6 months, but the benchlands created lasted for longer, although wretched as it was and undersupplied and used as a concentration area by police, it was to a large extent autonomous. People, in their own way, if they didn't run it, they at least were able to form their own communities and community groups in the benchlands, had porta potties, had electrical charge stations, were downtown near services and all that kind of thing, until it was removed without really adequate storage and adequate sleeping quarters. There was the armory under the Salvation Army that was the pretext for removing it under the new anti-homeless camping ordinance that replaced the old sleeping ban in 2022. But let's get to the 2025 meeting of, I guess it was May 29th, kind of join it after it's begun, and we're going to catch a little of it. So Athena, who is running the meeting, or I should say was guiding the meeting, was laid in the background, kind of observing and catching the details of the meeting, and essentially allowing and encouraging others to speak or listening to what others had to say. I myself am far less patient with stuff that feels to me to be off the agenda, and I have to commend her for being able to do that. Anyway, let's hear some of it. I'll interrupt briefly. It's going to be a little chaotic, as it was for me. And in a way, like I was swimming upstream, but it was also, well, stuff came out, and here comes what came out.
Starting here, it's just check-ins. Mm-hmm. And so anything you want to add, such as a discussion of your item, you can do that.
Well, add a check-in of my
initiative. That's Troy.
My initiative.
Okay, the
Troy's initiative.
The Troy initiative.
I'll take Captain America's initiative.
I don't know. Captain America might not appreciate that. Okay, so the main thing I generally jump on, and I guess I'll avoid this until Athena shows up.
Well, MHCAN, I want to have that in there.
MHCAN is with Athena.
Okay.
Huff disruption policy is, again, what she was working on, so we'll wait for that.
And in fact, MHCAN is in the process of being defunded, or there's a real threat of that at the Board of Supervisors. That was a major issue of our concern. I don't think we got much to it, except Laura reported that there was, Laura Chatham reported that there was she had a real concern that it was almost a done deal, that there was no real concern about saving MHCAN's funding. But we didn't get much into that. We continue with a discussion, as you can hear, of other items.
And I take it nobody here, and I could be wrong, Troy, are there any court cases or 5150s coming up that anybody wants to bring up or has heard of?
5150, of course, is a welfare and institutions code that puts people forcibly behind psychiatric bars, so to speak, and in many jurisdictions, either they get forced drugging, or in Santa Cruz, they get sent to areas or have been sent to areas where they can be forcibly drugged, like Sacramento and San Jose.
About recently, in the last week.
Yeah. I saw Justin Moore last week. He's on Facebook, by the way.
Justin Moore. This one sounded totally cool.
Mm-hmm. Which Justin?
What? Justin Moore.
Okay. Now that is a pretty good case. Cool. Let me take a question.
Look at the man, and he beat him up.
The light coming up.
He beat both his cases. And now he's taking
him
to
court. Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, I don't come in here and give us an update on his case, but I don't see
Thank
him,
you.
But they probably had to go to a meal or something.
Well, yeah, no, that's true. Well, you know, anybody got a number for, I probably do somewhere.
We might.
We can give
them
a call.
Street sweep reports already. I have one right now.
Well, go ahead.
They're right there at 11 o'clock. They're raiding the, we're going, supposedly going to go back behind the tannery, the dog park, to get all the guys out of there. I thought there was like 15 or 20 campers out there, but.
This is Troy talking about his visit that same morning, I believe, or yesterday, I'm not sure which, to check out the encampment in back of the tannery residential art project, which was threatened. Well, you'll hear Troy talk about it. He went out to help his friend Ernie move his stuff because the police were threatening to arrive. You can never tell when they're going to come, which makes it difficult for community support members to actually be there to document what goes on when, in many cases, the police simply destroy property or claim they're going to store it and don't, or claim they're giving people shelter options but aren't really, or the social service providers that are claiming it don't actually have it, as we found by our conversations with Evan Morrison at other times, that there's very few vacancies up in the actual armory. Evan Morrison is the head of the armory, but apparently defers a lot to his staff of more than 50 people who run things up there, without a lot of clear guidelines that people have, as far as I can see. We've been trying to find that out without making a lot of headway in terms of suggesting the kind of rules that actually might be more humane, decent, less prison-like, more actually prone to help people so-called either transfer or move on to housing or better shelter, or at least survive in a human fashion in the shelter they're in, as many are. It's been extended beyond the 6-month periods that they were allowed, because it's... it's really the only main shelter. I mean, there's a 1220 shelter out at River Street, and there's the Association of Faith Communities one-night shelter or two-week shelter. I'm a little unsure what their immediate situation is there. But, you know, there are hundreds and hundreds of people outside, and they simply face the destruction of their camps, their communities, and the seizure of their property, as usual, in spite of the rosy descriptions of the city manager, the homeless czar, and the city council, or the shitty council, as I think more accurately describes how they behave in this situation.
There's only like 10 today, and in that time, like the space of an hour between 9 and 10, or 10:30, we got the other 10 out of there pretty much, so everybody pretty much got out of there before they came, but they had to leave stuff behind, so they were in a hurry, so that's what the street report. Then someone came back over from Coral Street and said,
first
the police
that report, were... Try before we get into the next one. Regarding the Tannery report.
Mm-hmm. They got notified Friday with throwing stickers to be out of there at 11 a.m. today.
Friday.
Is that what you were going to ask?
No, but that's good information anyway. I was wondering, when did you show up there? Did you notice the time when you showed up?
Well, I was looking for my friend Ernie. The last couple of days, he wasn't home, and then when I did find him, he was home this morning, and he was backing up frantically because he hadn't got the notice until this morning. They put it on the 10th on Friday, and I guess he was gone for a while.
I mean, this morning you were out there at the tannery.
Yes. I don't know if they came or not. I left at like 10:30.
What time did you get there?
8,
okay. I think that was your question.
And yeah, and how long did you stay? Do you remember?
You said like 10:30.
An hour and a half.
All right. So what did you
I'm
called?
I'm standing in the back there too.
Well, you did call. You called the 216 line. You know, the Google line, which is great.
I just looked at my paperwork.
So it's good to have somebody calls the line.
I just looked at my paperwork.
And the 216 line is the number we have gotten set up through Bridgie Meisler that. Actually records people's accounts of what's been happening with them and is a way of centralizing and collating and maintaining information so that there can be a record of what's going on, at least from the perspective of folks whose property is being taken, whose residence is being destroyed for the moment and are being essentially told to leave with the false promise that there's housing elsewhere.
And Laura called me and said, you know, any suggestions what we should do? And I said, you know, I suggested she call Athena and you, Laura, but she may have left you a message.
She might be where Gina is.
And then she's at home, but she's coming with Greg as well.
Okay. Are you finished
up, Daisy? He was busy. But he would call the response team and see if they could find somebody out there. And then she called you back, better she'd done that earlier, to find out what's going on. You said, well, it looks like everybody's gone, is what you were saying.
Do you have dragon speak?
What is that?
It's where you speak like at a meeting like this and it types it up for you. You can, with the AI ability now, you can have types it up. With the AI ability now, you can have it write your letters out or write your things in. But I think that's one of the reasons that people that get you wrong, Robert, because you're trying to remember what they said because you want to put it into your writings somehow. And they, like me, you talk too fast and put too much information and you can't remember it all from when I started. Right?
And that's a part of that. Now, you were, in fact, getting on to your next street report, which was beyond the tannery. Go ahead.
When Sergio came over here, but I saw me and Ernie moving Ernie's stuff, he said, they're up on Coral Street right now, so I guess they were up on Coral Street at 8 a.m. Harassing people down in that during it. And I don't know if anybody's stuff got taken or what. I didn't go over to Coral Street. I don't like going.
And of course, Coral Street is the location of the what we call it, funding matters, they call it housing matters, where housing matters essentially does nothing or little or even supports the police raids on their area right in front of them, as long as they can continue their operation, their multi-million dollar operation, which serves only a minority of the homeless population. And again, provides its funding through a false promise of housing to the homeless and to middle-class citizens whose tax dollars are supporting this.
Coral Street. pulled over and what do you call that, detained for a moment yesterday. Because
you were pulled over on your skateboard, bicycle?
What? I was actually watching Kyle's white truck bicycle outside of Starving Musician.
Okay.
And I was looking at this MacBook Pro computer laptop that I had found in the bushes behind the Natural History Museum on Seabright Street. There was like a bag down there with all these little post-it notes and other papers in there. And I saw that. I was like, what was that? So I went down and around and actually asked the freaking plants for permission. Mm-hmm. I did. I was like, oh, don't mind.
Okay, so you had that on your possession when they talked to you.
I found this laptop in the stuff. And I grabbed it, and I did. I got it in my backpack for a while and wondered what I would do with it because I really want one. And then when I was in front of the Starving Musician, I pulled it out. When he came out, or while I was sitting there, this girl walked back and forth a couple of times. And I said, and then he came out, and I said, dude, I can't find this girl on the, that face comes up on there. And I said, I'm going to try just putting her into Google. And I did, and it came up that she was on LinkedIn. So I was like, bam. So
wait, this is the person, this is the owner of the computer?
Yeah.
Okay, and so you were trying to connect to say, hey, I found your gear.
I just did. I was just doing that, and I had
James interrupted.
LinkedIn, sign in with my Google account, do all this shit, and I still had to, accept my friend's request or message request. Also, the cop comes up and says, excuse me, can you sit down? You're in possession of stolen property. I need you to sit down on the curb. And I said, what? I want to sit down. Why can't I stand? Well, you're being detained, sir, for whatever, and to...
Wait, so that thing had a tracking mechanism on it.
In a stolen possession of a stolen computer, and you're being detained, so please follow my orders. So I shoot down on a curb, and Kyle's sitting there right there, and he's like, and I'm like, man, I was just trying to find this girl on LinkedIn, and the cop, I showed him. Police officer,
picture. You showed the picture what you were doing on the computer. So he had to eat crow. So he had to eat
his phone.
Oh, but you had to eat.
He still kept me there while they ran a warrant check, while they said I have state warrants and all this. And then his commander came up and showed him a video of people like smashed into this person's car and stole stuff. And he said, no, that's not him or something. So that confirmed too that I wasn't guilty.
Good.
But I showed the commander that I had that I was looking her up to give it to her, find her, give it back on LinkedIn. And he just let me go. They did a contact card on me, which they broke down, wrote on a piece of paper, not on a computer, not on anything. They wrote on a piece of paper my name, birthday, address, telephone number. They took a picture of me like this. It's like a contact card.
But you know what's interesting is that turned on computer led the police to the computer, which happened to be in your hand. So it's a good thing that you were actually being a good Samaritan about it.
He said, funny thing, you went all the way to the Poganip, and you went here and there, and all the places where any dope head would go to sell the thing. And I was like,
that's what the officer said?
Yeah.
You know which officer it was?
Sir, young, really young, looking, Asian or Hispanic, kind of like a dude. He's kind of, he's heavy set, really heavy set.
I haven't seen that officer yet. Well, I'm sorry that that happened, but it could have been weird. Well,
but they didn't arrest me.
They didn't arrest me.
Yeah, that's lucky. That's lucky.
But obviously, they had a tracker on that computer.
Exactly what you're talking about. And the tracker, I also had a friend whose house was broken into, and he had a tracker on his computer. The computer went to Concord and then to Marin, and when he called the police and told them where the computer was, they said, sorry, it's just a computer. We don't do that kind of work.
You know, that's when you kind of have to take the law and you need to take your own jurisprudence into your own hand. And if it's telling you where the computer is, go where the computer is.
Yeah. Well, he didn't, I don't think. You know, you never know what you're going to find when you get there. Now,
this is true.
You did was perfect because you got in touch with the person who owned it.
Well, I didn't. I was waiting for her to get in touch with her.
But you still have a paper trail that you did.
It was her and her friends that saw me holding it, trying to find her.
Oh.
Wait, what? I don't understand.
Did it get stolen from her somebody tossed it?
I just opened it up, pulled it out of my backpack, opened it up. I was asking Meta, Facebook Meta, if it could take a picture and look for that person because I couldn't find her on Facebook.
Okay.
So then I was going to try to take a picture of it with their name and everything and something.
And posted on.
The cop said, you should have just turned it in at the police department. And yeah, but I was going to see if the Google search thing could find her that way. But then all of a sudden I just said, I'm just going to put it into Google. And I put it into Google and her name came up on LinkedIn. And that was how I could message her, so I did, in the process of doing that. And
how long did the cop hold?
I was there like 20, 30 minutes.
That could have been worse.
Yeah.
That could have been worse.
Yeah, I could still charge
that
you.
That could have been worse.
I could still charge you possession of stolen property. I don't know how you got this, where you got it, you're just your savings.
Yeah, exactly.
The bottom line,
I could still charge you with it.
He could
still
charge
you.
That's exactly what Jesse's felony charges.
That, okay,
he
that
found
was
a lost laptop.
I remember.
He turned it into the police if he got charged.
Really?
What?
No way.
Yes.
Did you hear that?
That was months ago.
And then Athena points out that someone else who turned a computer into the police then got charged for the stolen property. Here she is talking about it, a little hard to hear.
That was
no wonder I wouldn't turn it in then. No wonder my good intuition came kicked in for me. Yeah. But my bad intuition was to pull it out there on Pacific Avenue. No, but it had a tracker.
He got charged because he turned it in. He gave it to the police and then...
What they told him to do. You got that, right? You were supposed to turn it in, but you get arrested if you did? No, you're better off doing what you did.
You did fine. But sadly, the police don't want it.
On the other hand, I don't doubt anything. It's just... It gets weirder and weirder.
It does. If I found a computer, I'd leave it there. Somebody else
knows. Anywhere in the continental United States except for Hawaii or Alaska to get your ass. Bring you back here.
Okay, but also they'll let you walk around downtown with a warrant. So, it's kind of... depends.
Maybe it's the Sheriff's Department's wacky commander or something over there at the jail. I don't know, but somehow I believe what they told me.
Yeah.
That they'll come get you anywhere for a Santa Cruz warrant.
Sure.
And there has been some confusion based on what I have had, based on the accounts I've heard from people, that the courts have really stopped going after people in Santa Cruz for warrants based upon, a failure to appear in court or a failure to attend a camping ban ticket hearing. This was before the old camping ban expired in 2022, as mentioned before, was replaced. But it was still, it still may be the case that they are trying to avoid sheriff's resources because it's and police resources by going after people who they know they're going to have to hold in jail and then release, even if they're found guilty, because these are minor charges that are reoccurring. Things like setting up a campsite, if you're going to do that for people, if you're going to arrest them, the charges may well be dropped by courts because they, not from their humanitarian purposes usually, but simply for purposes of court efficiency. Anyway, it's time for another David Rovick's number. And this one is prefaced by Rovick's sentence, "White supremacists rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, killing Heather Heyer and injuring dozens." Name of the song, "Today in Charlottesville."
In August 2017, some hundreds of right-wing activists from various groups held a rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, which was opposed by thousands of people. Physical confrontations became violent, particularly when a car was driven into a group of people as they were marching in the street and Heather Heyer was killed. The confrontational fascists versus Antifa character of Charlottesville, with two sides that completely vilify each other being portrayed by media as either angels or devils, depending on the media's bias, became increasingly the norm as the Trump and Biden eras and the era of polarized performative media progressed. There was a massacre in church that got certain forces moving. Many towns are now at least superficially improving, such as in Virginia.
where a statue of General Lee stands as a reminder of the days of slavery. In the city center, an indelible mark in the spot that's been renamed Emancipation Park, slated for removal when a judge intervened, which might be the moment that most fully set the scene for 19 injured, one killed today in Charlottesville. With their man in the White House, members of the right marched through the university, torches alight, chanting against immigrants, Africans and Jews, but it's not the flying bottles that put them in the news so much as the bigot in the car, revving his engine loud, speeding forward and then back, running down the crowd, using the same tactic promoted by Islamic State. Maybe he was even shouting, God is great. 19 injured, one killed today in Charlottesville. Used to be in chains, now their descendants, who still remain, are being forced to leave by gentrification, just like poor white folks all across the nation. And with the presidential tweets and xenophobic rants, it's just a matter of time when some pawn takes the chance to plow into a march with half a ton of steel. This is not fake news, it's real. 19 injured, one killed, today in Charlottesville.
So I'm going to play a little bit more of this, but this is the attempt to get through the agenda items that I'm not, since I'm not running the meeting and I'm not, it's not my turn to do that, because I proceed somewhat differently in these meetings. It's nonetheless, this is the kind of stuff that we talk about, which you'll hear a little bit of, depending on which meeting you come to, but also... Here's this meeting.
Building downtown, their attempt to shovel it through a very compliant city council. It also has to do with events.
Complicit city council.
As well as complicit, correct. Free events, there's something about free events. There's a thing coming up on Sunday, which is...
Pride?
No, is it Friday?
Pride.
No, Sunday.
No, it's also Friday, you're right. Friday, May 30th. Is the Arboretum thing.
Oh, what's at the Arboretum?
The Arboretum is elaborately described for those who have microscopic vision right here.
Oh, boy.
Good luck.
I think I have a...
And I'm handing to Laura a description off of the Indie Media calendar of an event that was happening up at the UCSC, a free event, and that was the reason that I brought it up to the group, because... folks, the few homeless folks who do attend these meetings, and there were, I think, three at least, Greg and Troy and a third person whose name I never remember. There's a fourth. There was Thomas as well. So that we actually get a contingent of people who, it's important that there are at least free event options because they don't have the resources to come to the other ones.
Magnifying glass in my
head. I think it's a free event.
May 30th and 31st for a series of site-specific performances. Events will happen simultaneously. All are free, and you are encouraged to walk around in the Grove, where we will be performing. Hope to see you there between 5:30 and 8 p.m. both days, where we will perform our piece three times each night. See you there. Come early to the Arboretum in full bloom. And
it's UCSC, if anybody's interested.
A dawn and two dusks.
Okay, I'll read them.
Yeah, please.
There's a June 4th meeting on 8-story housing development that's coming up. On unfortunately, it's not a meeting.
Oh, it's not in person?
No, they don't want to do that in person.
Oh my goodness, I mean, if there's anybody dumber than the city council members, it's the people who donate time to the planning meetings. I've gone to
here's the several. Here's a story called the San Jose Way, arresting the homeless and encamped with sweeps. It's more recent.
Yeah.
Curious what they're doing in San Jose.
I saw it.
Yeah. Are you sure that's not an in-person meeting? Because from what I read, it seemed like it could.
Too big of a
hole. I think I'm handing it to
I'll look at it afterwards, but I'm pretty sure it is. There is that option, but it's very painful to listen to those people who know nothing about the construction industry talking.
Yeah, correct.
Only like that.
Oh, yeah. We all do. Let's see what we got here. This is another item that I can read if I look at it. It's Planning Commission regarding Ninth Street. Eight-story building. There's another thing on that thing if you're interested in either of you. And here's an urging of the city council to consider it faulty EIR, drop option there from the down. I'm not following all of it, but for those of you who are interested.
Poor Ninth Street.
I think this has already gone through the city council initially. I don't know. The other thing is, and this is just regarding what we did this morning, what you did, Troy, and what we're able to do is begin to get a record of what's happening, even if it's, you know, not when the notice is given, because that would be better if we could, but, you know, I think actually somebody may have noticed, you may have noticed, Athena may have noticed, you may have noticed it at the last meeting.
That there was the tannery was tagged?
That the tannery, there was a Friday.
Yeah.
Notice given there was going to be sweeps, and that maybe that's what did you what brought you down there, Troy? Just friends you
know? For Ernie, friend of mine,
helping Ernie move.
Yeah, that's what I ended up doing.
So anyway, the Google line seems to be working, and although there's some questions about it, Laura said she's going to try to contact Reggie, who set it up.
And the Google line is. Again, a reminder to those who are interested and may have forgotten what it is 216-8239, 216-8239. You can leave reports of problems with police, things you've seen that seem abusive, or positive result or accounts, too. If you can, officers' names and numbers. If you haven't got them, that's fine. Locations, times, witnesses, or at least maybe... If you want to do it anonymously, you can do that too, but just the location of what happened could be helpful in the time. And also any service problems where you're feeling excluded or you're getting particularly good service from whether it's funding matters or the people first, if you can ever get to talk to them and get them to pay any attention to what you're talking about up at the Armory and other services too, Association of Friends, Community. Faith communities. Let's get back to what we were listening to.
And I have various possible things that can be given out to people, some of which are longer, some of which are much shorter, and some of which, many of you have already seen, but I brought some of them along just to see which of these you like. This is the shortest one. It looks like this. A little strip of paper.
Cool.
Easy to keep in your pocket.
And this is a strip of paper that has the number 216-8239. So homeless folks or anybody can carry it around in their pocket, and if they see something, they can contact the Google line and report it. Often I hand out 8.5 by 11 sheets of flyers which have more details, and so I was offering the group different kinds of different sizes, half page, full page, tiny strip, and so forth.
Easy to lose, well, but you know. Then there's a longer one, which looks like this. It has a number of more stuff. I don't know which people want to use, if any of these. I mean, if you take them with you and people want to know or are interested in this, they can pass them on to other people. Since in my view, one of the few ways we'll eventually get pushback against the what's happened to the folks at Coral Street and down in the cannery is if we can do a lawsuit or somebody can do a lawsuit. And that's only going to happen if documentation starts accumulating, that people can say, okay, there's a picture that this is their stuff, and here's a picture, and here's somebody else's testimony that it's being moved, and here's somebody saying it was my stuff, please don't move it, or where's the storage you're taking it to, when can I pick it up? That sort of stuff, if it's documented, in theory, a lawyer could say, oh, I can make a little money off this shit, as they did in some cities.
Not like anymore. You don't like doing
like
that.
Like in Fresno,
that's
back in the Kincaid case, which Thomas knows about. So, yeah. So it's just, I think it's a good thing to do, a basic thing to do, and to start encouraging people to do it, even though it's not going to work immediately.
I asked a crew this morning or something like that. I said, well, I got this number. They made this number for to call in if any have sweeps or things like that, or get your stuff taken and stuff like that. He says, man.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not going to happen immediately.
We don't care about that, man. People are in survival mode, man. Most of the people that are homeless, they can't even fight for themselves. They have to have someone fight for them.
That could well be, but I think that is one of the things that can be offered to people.
You know, that's a fascinating observation. I mean, I would say the same thing about the people that are housed.
The system also blocks any ability to self-advocate, which is really interesting. My friend just got housed recently, and they couldn't sign up for a welcome basket or any sort of, like, supplies without a case manager doing that sign-up for them. Same thing with the coordinated entry system for the county housing program. You have to have someone else enter you into the system. You can't do it yourself. Same thing with a lot of different, like, medical, like RCC or, like, any other medical, like, programs, you often have to get someone to refer you in. You're not allowed to refer yourself in. So, like, there's the survival mode aspect of, like, how the fuck could I fight for myself right now? I'm just trying to, like, live. But also, when you go to these buildings and say, I'd like to fight for myself, is there any opportunities for me? You're not allowed to do anything for yourself. You have to have someone else do it.
Do you know if this is a recent change, Athena?
No, I think that's systematic. I don't think that's recent.
I wonder when I took people to HPHP, did that count as me being advocate? Because the thing was that I had really good experience with HPHP, that they just, you know, if we come up and say, oh, this person is hurt, they take them right in and they treat them really wonderful. And I'm hoping...
HPHP is the Homeless Persons Health Project.
That they're not cutting funding for them.
HPHP is definitely having funding costs cut because they've been, like, changing how they hand out things. Ever since they moved back to Coral Street, their funding is clearly less. The nurses are clearly stressed.
Oh, my God.
And there's, like, stress on a, like, whole nother level than I've usually seen.
Oh, shit.
They moved back to Coral Street, like, in August or something. No, what month is... No, that's when they left. They came back at some point in 2025, back to Coral Street, and they don't.
A couple months ago.
Yeah, they can't give you ibuprofen without a doctor. They can't give you Orajel. Like a lot of the things that people would regularly be able to just, like, walk up and get, they don't have any.
Are they back in the same place?
They're back at the same place, yeah. And HPHP doesn't have the barrier of someone has to recommend you.
And that's Coral Street, the Funding Matters complex at 115 Coral Street.
It's like programs past HPHP that have those barriers. Like, often through the county, you have to have a recommendation in order to do literally anything.
That might be something to go to the Board of Supervisors and tell them, I agree. You know, because... Yeah, if we say that a few times in front of the Board of Supervisors, some of those guys will realize how stupid it is. It's costing. It adds a lot of costs.
It does.
Now, it may be that the federal or state laws are requiring, and that's probably what it is.
And I always get discouraged when I hear this suggestion to go to the Board of Supervisors and work through a committee and so forth. Because when we founded Huff decades ago, what we did was we went directly to the people that were engaged in either the abuses or not providing the services they were claiming they were doing. And we put pressure on them through publicly exposing what was going on and demanding changes, not that we demanding that other people listen to us or we did some of the going to Board of Supervisors and City Council. When we found they weren't listening to us, even though we presented reasonable arguments and lots of testimony, we went to the public more generally. We engaged in civil disobedience, which I guess I continue to feel is still the way to go, even though it involves a greater risk and we're more of a fascist-enabled state here than, say, in the late 80s and the early 90s when protest was in flower to some extent, and early 2000s too to some extent. But good things and bad things all come to an end, at least in the short term. And here's a final number from David Rovics, which he introduces by saying the state of Arizona cracks down further on those trying to keep refugees from dying on the border. He sings, "I was a stranger."
Hundreds of people die every year trying to cross the border from Mexico into the U.S. They often die of thirst and exposure, insufficiently equipped for the extreme conditions in the more remote parts of the border where attempting the journey is most popular. For a very long time, there has been a tradition in the desert to leave water out there for people to find. One of the organizations that's been doing that in a methodical way for many years is No More Deaths, No Más Muertes. They follow in the footsteps of Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement, giving food to the hungry, clothing to the naked, welcome to the stranger. In 2018, the legislature in Arizona passed a new law involving extreme amounts of prison time for anyone who seeks to follow the instructions laid out in Matthew 25:35, providing the possibility of decades in prison for anyone who knowingly provides lodging or transportation for someone who is undocumented.
If you go to Pima County in the Sonoran desert lands, you'll find the town of Ajo among the cactus stems. The only town you'll see, the only water too. When someone is thirsty, there's no question what you do. For well over a century, it was a normal thing to have an extra jug of water that you might bring. In the harsh Sonoran Arizona summer heat, we'd rather give the vultures something else to eat. You didn't ask where I was going, nor where I'd been. I was hungry, you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was naked, you gave me clothes. I was a stranger. I have this book here, a story I learned well. I always thought I understood the tale that it tells. It's spelled out very clearly in Matthew 25. What a good Christian does when a stranger arrives. You didn't ask where I was going, nor where I'd been. I was hungry, you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink.
I was naked, you gave me clothes. I was a stranger. You let me in. Now there's a crackdown with life and death on trial. The only place with water for 100 miles. Facing 20 years in prison is a very mighty rod. Now all of us are forced to choose between Caesar and God. You didn't ask where I was going, nor where I'd been. I was hungry, you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was naked, you gave me clothes. I was a stranger.
And that winds it up, really, for the current version of the Bathrop Spears Broadside Show, whatever it is. We now turn to the flashback, which we jump back to June 24th, 2012, which is packed. It's a 3-hour-long flashback. Begins with a lot of updates, which I give in the first 15 to 30 minutes. And I talk a lot about the communications that John Colby and I have had with Mayor Lane regarding complaints about the what then was then called the Homeless Services Center. We called it the Homeless Lack of Services Center. Now it's known as Housing Matters, or perhaps more accurately known as Funding Matters. Anyway, complaints from some of its attempted clients or former clients, Andrea Morgan, Steve Lazarus, about how they were treating disabled people. This was in the context of a conversation with Free Radio broadcaster Matthew Embry. Maybe he was a former one at that point. I think he may have been, or he may have just been traveling. He did have a show then for a while called Clatterbox. We then discuss direct action as a better alternative than waiting for bureaucrats or courts or city council to turn an ear toward you and make any kind of response. I talk about ACLU inaction around obvious issues like the sleeping ban. There was a protest at the town clock against the National Defense Authorization Act, which essentially begins the authority, which he probably already used anyway, of the Fuhrer, that is our president, or their president, I should say, to I guess it's to charge, and I think it may even be designate, and I'm not sure if they would. It actually includes eliminate. I should be, but my knowledge of the actual proposals of the 2012 NDAA, which I think has been renewed yearly or quarterly or bi-yearly. Again, I'm not operating off of specific evidence. It allows for indefinite detention, and it's we had involved protests at the town clock where we hear the comments of Dennis Etler, Angel, others. And then a long segment on the Berkeley City Council's public comment, perhaps some of the debate at the Berkeley City Council on their sitting ban proposal, which, you know, we had our sitting ban. We still have our sitting ban. It's illegal to sit within 14 feet of a building, 14 feet of a cafe, a sidewalk cafe, 14 feet of a bench, 14, almost, I think at one point I estimated it was up to 90, 95 or more percent of the sidewalk was criminal to sit, except on the limited benches that are around. Not that the police are enforcing this at the moment in 2025. We also have Red Church interviews coming up at this 2012 flashback. A couple turned away at Coral Street because they were full, as they always often were. We have Steve Plaich talking about his Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project.
about the police no longer provide bikes that are damaged or unclaimed to giving them away to the bike church. They stopped doing that, but instead began giving them away to the bike dojo connected to a city council member, which is, I don't know if we call it corruption or favoritism, I don't know. Then there he discusses the forum on the Santa Cruz 11 on community TV, which I wish we still had, because the Santa Cruz 11 case, the case of the folks who were held after the Occupy movement, instead of going after people who actually organized and participated in the occupation of the 75, or was it 74, I never remembered these days, the River Street Bank at the corner of River and Water Streets. They went after 11 activists in the community, and I think all but four of us were eventually, after a year of endless court hearings, charges were dropped. Originally, we faced 7 years in prison, and it was quite an ordeal. I had hoped it would be an opportunity, but maybe it was. Maybe I don't see it fully, even with the distance of time. I don't know. In any case, it's all yours to listen to and to brood on and to read about. If you want to go to Santa Cruz Indie Media, you can find a quicker way if you're impatient with listening to these shows, of looking at the actual reports from the Times, which I and others wrote. It's indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, I suggest you go to. I also suggest, again, that you use the number 216-8239 to report abuses by police and service agencies and other officials, or neighborhood groups, for that matter, 216-8239, so that we can keep a record of what's going on and eventually have evidence to show to the wider community, which mainly simply isn't, I think, aware of this stuff. The media, mainstream media, doesn't make us aware of it and so forth. So that's it for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. If you have stuff you think should have been in here or stuff you want to put in a future Bathrop Spears Broadside show, assuming I have the motivation and energy to do another one, which is becoming a little more problematic with each one, but I continue ditto with the Huff meetings. Let me know. If you want some flyers to distribute or informational flyers for folks to understand what's going on in spite of the rosy claims of the city council's, well, its publicists, give me a call, 423-4833. That's the Huff line, now going to a cell phone, so you may even get the real me more frequently, or at least get a machine that you can use, leave a message on. That's if you want to talk with me, 423-4833, particularly about the show or other homeless issues that you don't think are appropriate in putting up on the 216-8239 number, the 216-8239 Google number. And that is about it. If you've been listening, thank you for listening. And of course, if you are interested in some of the history of all this, what went up was going on 13 years ago, and to some extent it's relevant, keep listening, because that's the show that's coming up next.